Just waiting for the child to cry. Just the next thing on cue. Okay. Well, here we are in Sri Vrindavan Dham, the land of Krishna. This looking less like the land of Krishna and more like Disneyland every day. The road coming here is like filled with billboards and come and buy, come and enjoy. Fortunately, the spiritual potency of Vrindavan doesn't change even if people go crazy. So we can somehow pray, be a little sincere, and pray for the mercy of Radha and Krishna. I don't think it's going to work. You can try, but I don't think it's going to work. He wants to play. Something about children and Srimad Bhagavatam class that just don't seem to work. So I know I'm going to pray. Hope you all will all also pray to Radha Krishna or Radha Shyamasundara for their mercy, so that our short stay here in Sri Vrindavan Dham will have some lasting spiritual impact on our hearts as we're making an effort to journey back to them. Specifically in the form of hearing this Srimad Bhagavatam, which is non-different than Krishna also, and the message of Krishna comes through. If you listen carefully, you'll hear. I chose to speak about the pastime of Bharat Maharaj. I'm a little surprised, not totally surprised, but a little surprised that Bhakti Marg Swami, who every place he goes, he performs drama, and this year the drama that he's composed that was presented in Mayapur several times in the course of this coming year would be presented by the entire traveling bus that goes throughout North America for all the festivals of Rath Yatra and so many other engagements that they set up in Canada and elsewhere. The Three Lives of Bharat. And in the drama, it has some creative portions that aren't really what the storyline goes, but it's, you know, it's an effective rendering of Bharat Maharaja's life. A lot of people are going to be meditating on and pondering on the life of Bharat Maharaj this coming year. So significant is Bharat Maharaj that many times Prabhupada would say the whole planet was named after him. Very great king. And in the chapter that presents who Bharat Maharaj's, what his life was, a little description proceeds by his eight generations, counting Garbhadaksha and Vishnu, he's eight generations away from the Supreme Lord. So, Garbhadaksha and Vishnu, his the firstborn living being is Lord Brahma. That's one and two. And from Lord Brahma, Swayambhuva Manu directly appears from the body of Lord Brahma. The first of the children, sons and daughters of Swayambhuva Manu, was Priyavrata. And that's number three. So Priyavrata had a son named Agnidhara. Agnidhara had a son named Nabhi. Nabhi had a son named Rishabdev. And Rishabdev had a son named Bharat. So out of those eight, we have three who are forms of the Lord, Garbhadaksha, Vishnu. The Lord Brahma is a guna avatar, Manu is a manvantar avatar, and Rishabdev is another avatar, a form of the Lord. So four out of eight. And the others aren't small-time personalities either. They're perfected or nearly perfected beings. That's not very common. So Rishabdev, that description comes at the beginning of the earlier part of the fifth canto, and then from Rishabdev, he instructs his 100 sons, and Rishabdev entrusted the kingdom. This means the kingdom means the whole world. He entrusted the ruling of the whole world to Bharat Maharaj. He requested his son to marry Panchajani was the wife that he was requested to marry, and from his wife, five sons were born, and according to Srimad Bhagavatam, he ruled for an incredible number of years. It's like 1,000 times 10,000, so that you do the math, and it's 100 million years. And I can't figure that one out, because the maximum duration, the standard duration of life in Satyayuga, because this is Satyayuga, 100,000 years. 100,000 years, and he ruled for 100 times that. So does the math doesn't exactly work. So he lived for an extraordinarily long time and ruled for that extraordinarily long time. And during the whole duration of time that he ruled, the citizens were to be ruled by such a qualified person. He extended protection to them, as is the duty of a king. But he didn't just extend them protection from any outside force, because there wasn't any outside force. He was the ruler of the whole world. But he gave them protection by engaging all of his citizens in their prescribed duties, because when one engages in prescribed duties means in relation to the personality of Godhead, then one feels satisfied. And if one does not engage in one's prescribed duties for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is not satisfied. The mind becomes disturbed, and the mind is disturbed, then disturbing behavior will come. But there wasn't disturbing behavior because people were all nicely engaged. And details are presented in this chapter. This is chapter 7 of Canto 5. The process that he followed. He followed the process of, this is Satya Yuga, so he engaged in meditation. But in addition to meditation, he chanted Vedic mantras. And specifically, it's said that he chanted Gayatri mantra. But it's specifically also indicating that when he chanted Gayatri mantra, he wasn't worshipping the sun, nor was he worshipping the impersonal feature of the Supreme. Because some people who chant Gayatri mantra are worshipping the sun or worshipping the impersonal Brahman. That's their meditation upon the meaning of the mantra. When you chant mantra, there should be meditation upon the meaning of the mantra. But specific, he was worshipping the form of Narayana. Prabhupada elaborately discusses this. The expansion of Narayana, who becomes the worshipable deity of the sun god and the residents of the sun planet, or Surya Narayan. And just as the sun is maintaining the whole universe, that is, that the light of the sun is providing sustenance for all vegetation that grows, as well as the light of the moon, which is the reflected light of the sun, allows for the vegetables to grow very nicely, and the heat of the sun. So Prabhupada's remark is that according to modern science, the sun is sustaining the universe. But it's not actually the sun that's sustaining the universe, it's Lord Narayan that's sustaining the universe. He's the presiding deity of the sun planet. And this is how it works in according to Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Also, for example, in Indra Loka, Indra is there personally worshipping his younger brother, who is Vamanadeva. Because Vamana appears as the son of Kasyapa and Aditi, as did Indra. To honor Indra's service to the Personality of Godhead, Vamana allows, he resides there, and he allows Indra to worship him. So every day he doesn't just get up and, you know, go to the temple room and worship his deity. He worships Lord Vamana. So, like that, similarly, the sun has a presiding deity, an expansion of Lord Narayan, known by different names, sometimes known as Surya Narayan, sometimes known as Hiranyagarbha, but he is the personality of Godhead. And it's the effulgence of the personality of Godhead that is the sustenance of the universe. And so Bharat Maharaj knew that. He was worshipping the personality of Godhead. And because he was engaging everybody in his kingdom, and not everybody in his kingdom was on the same platform of pure devotion to the personality of Godhead that he was, he therefore engaged many priests in different types of yajñas. Some of those yajñas, they're mentioned. Agnihotra, Darsha, Purnamasa, Chaturmasya, Pashu Yajna, or Ashwamedha Yajna, Soma Yajna, and so many yajnas that we don't do. Now, Prithu Maharaj, who was a incarnation of the Lord, and for that matter, Maharaj Yudhisthira, they engaged in Ashwamedha Yajnas. The commentators explain, one might wonder, what if he's so elevated in pure devotion, why is he doing this yajna, that yajna, the other yajna? Besides, it's Satya Yuga, and it's the process is meditation. So both questions arise, and they address it this way. He was on such a platform of devotional service that he saw everything as a manifestation of the personality of Godhead. And so when a yajna was performed where Indra's name was invoked, he thought of Indra as the arms of the Lord. When a yajna was performed where the name of the sun god was invoked, he thought of the eye of the Lord, and so forth. He saw the various demigods as limbs of the body of the Lord. And Prabhupada's explanation is like this, that when you massage somebody's leg, you're not serving the leg. You're serving somebody who has a leg. And Bharat Maharaj was seeing like that, because our teaching of pure devotion, Rupa Goswami's definition is anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma jnanavritam. The recommendation is that pure devotional service, one doesn't take up any activity with a personal motivation or material desire. So these types of yajñas are not recommended for us for the most part because they're karmakanda. Therefore, furthering or enriching or enhancing one's position as an enjoyer within this world. That's why people do them. But Bharat Maharaj didn't take them up for that purpose. He was very singular in his meditation. It was part of his meditation upon the personality of Godhead, to meditate upon the various limbs of the Supreme Lord and how the Supreme Lord is maintaining and fulfilling the desires of all living entities. It wasn't for his own purpose of elevating himself through ritual means to come become a better enjoyer. Something like in the Nectar of Devotion, there's mention of worship of Ganesh as one of those 64 items. And that's at the time of Rupa Goswami. We're going back now in early parts of creation, where it's Bharat Maharaj and Satya Yuga. But even during Lord Chaitanya's time, this made its way into Nectar Devotion, the worship of Ganesh. And we know we don't worship Ganesh, and we know why we don't worship Ganesh. Prabhupada's explanation of why, he was asked once, "You've written in Nectar Devotion, one should worship Ganesh, but you didn't teach us that. Well, how come?" And Prabhupada's reply was, "If you worship Ganesh, your hearts are filled with material desire, he'll help you fulfill your material desire. And then you'll be more entangled in material existence. So I haven't taught you to worship Ganesh. But instead we worship Lord Nrisimhadev, so that the obstacles on our path of pure devotional service can be removed. Not the obstacles to achieve the fulfillment of some material desire." So it works if you don't have material desire. But it's an entanglement if you have material desire. So if anyone here is on the platform of having no material desire, you can follow that item of the 64 items of devotional service. And otherwise, not. In Lochan Das Thakur's Chaitanya Mangal, one of the early verses of invocation in the Mangalacharna section, he offers his worship to Ganesh. He was on that platform. And he was following Rupa Goswami and his teaching. And Bharat Maharaj was on that platform. So he was able to do like that. But he wasn't specifically mentioned. He didn't personally go and perform the yajñas. He engaged others in performing the yajñas, while he was engaged in hearing, chanting, and remembering the personality of Godhead. Something like, it's mentioned in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam in relation to Maharaj Ambarish, that he was a Krishna Bhakta. He worshipped the personality of Godhead in his temple and in his life. He had a deity, a Krishna deity. And he observed his Ekadasi Vrata here in Vrindavan. He was a Krishna Bhakta. But it's specifically mentioned also that there was some part of his kingdom, there was a big drought. Some persons suppose maybe that was Rajasthan, even then. Was dry. And there was no food production because there was no rain and the citizens were in difficulty. So he engaged some brahmanas in his kingdom in performing the appropriate rituals and yajñas so that the result of which there would be rain. Some kind of Indra yajña, doesn't mention specifically, but supposing something that would help to produce rain. It doesn't say he went there and he performed it along with them. He was worshiping Krishna. But he was engaging citizens according to their capacity. So, like that, Bharat Maharaj engaged people. That's not the same principle that we follow. This is Kali Yuga. That's Satya Yuga. People that were more qualified. People today are less qualified. Even to find qualified brahmanas to perform such yajñas, they don't exist, and therefore we don't do them at all. But in Satya Yuga, this is what Bharat Maharaj did. There's a verse in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. He refers to a verse from the 11th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. It's part of the Uddhava Gita section, where Krishna says, similarly, that until one is free from material desire, at which stage one can take up very nicely the process of hearing and chanting, then the other forms of uplifting, purification, and rituals are to be performed. So that's something like Prabhupada's statement of wanting to institute Varnashram Dharma within the world. And it's not that there's a growing interest on the part of certain devotees to see that wish that Prabhupada had be fulfilled. And I want to make a statement or two about what he meant by that. In the Varnashram talks during that period of time when Prabhupada was speaking about this, he was first of all commenting specifically that my disciples, they're not chanting their 16 rounds. They're not chanting their Gayatri mantras. They're not performing those activities that transform a conditioned soul into a Vaishnava. They're not doing those basic activities that elevate one to the transcendental Vaishnava position. Therefore, we must have Varnashram. Because at least with Varnashram, then there's observance of something that regulates one's life to bring about elevation according to one's psychophysical nature. It becomes, in other words, important for that section of society that will not take the elevator, maybe the staircase, to go up. And the elevator method is Nam Sankirtan and Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu, the direct processes of devotional service. We don't need to change the face of the Hare Krishna movement and become a Varnashram movement, where we're following Bhagavat Marg, and those who are following Bhagavat Marg will most quickly reach the goal of life. Varnashram is instead for persons who cannot, will not perform those activities. For those persons, then regulating their life according to the Varnashram institution is required. And doing so for the satisfaction of Vishnu. In the discussion between Lord Chaitanya and Ramananda Roy, you may recall because we discussed this when we went to the place where Ramananda Roy and Lord Chaitanya had their discussion on the bank of the Kaveri River. But when Lord Chaitanya was asking Ramananda Roy to describe what the goal of life is and the means to achieve it, his first offering, which Lord Chaitanya rejected, was the performance of duties according to Varnashram, Varnashramacharvata, that Lord Vishnu is to be pleased by the performance of Varnashram, and one cannot please Lord Vishnu if one fails to do these. So it's necessary to follow regulations, but one need not follow all those regulations. We're not at fault for not following all those regulations because we're chanting Krishna's holy name. And if we're not chanting Krishna's holy name, we need to follow those regulations. There are regulations that we are required to follow, and those are given to us by our Founder Acharya, Vaishnava Prabhupada, and we should strictly follow them. Minimally, the four regular principles and other forms of social etiquette or Vaishnava etiquette that Prabhupada has instructed us. But all the so many, 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 many other duties of grihasthas, or the duties according to your particular varna, they're exhaustive. One time Prabhupada described that if you had some idea of all the duties that you would have to perform as grihasthas, just getting out of bed before you even, you know, started doing anything in your day would be gone, because there's so many, the list is so long. So many things. So Lord Chaitanya has made it very easy for us in this age of Kali. We simply chant the holy name. So there's a lot of discussion in the commentary. I'm spending time on this. They're not making the same points that I'm making, but they spend like pages of discussion on why would Bharat Maharaj, a pure devotee, engage in karmakanda rituals. Like, we wouldn't do that. We're very clear, we don't do that. But it specifically mentions that he had those activities done in his kingdom. And so this is some explanation why. What was his consciousness when he was doing so? And what was the benefit being derived? What was the intention to keep his citizens properly engaged and elevated? Because the vastness of all citizens in any kingdom is not, they're all on the topmost level. It's just not the way it is. It isn't the way it is now, and it wasn't like that then, but because they had the proper king, they were engaged according to their propensity and according to their capacity, and that which would elevate them. And for himself, he was perfectly meditating upon the personality of Godhead throughout the 1,000 times 10,000 years that he was reigning as king. So, day by day, his attachment to Vasudev specifically is mentioned. Vasudev means Krishna. His attachment to Krishna, Vasudev, was becoming stronger and stronger and stronger. And he had a lot of days. He lived a very long time. And because of his Krishna consciousness, his citizens were similarly being benefited and were happy and prospering. It was a wonderful period of time. And it's said that he, Bharat, was charitable just like, or to the degree of his father. And his father was an incarnation of the Lord. And his father, Nabhi, during the reign of, commonly we hear Prabhupada say that Bharat Varsha, which is what this planet is presently known as, was formerly known as Ilavrati Varsha. Ilavrati Varsha. And then it became known as Bharat Varsha. And in this canto, fifth canto, chapter 7, there's other information given. It was named after his grandfather, Nabhi, and the name of the planet at that time was called Ajanabha Varsha. Formerly this planet was known as Ajanabha Varsha. It was known as Ajanabha Varsha after Nabhi. But after Bharat Maharaja's reign, in honor of him, it became Bharat Varsha. So, not only he ruled for such a long time, but the ruling of his kingdom was so fulfilling, so perfect, they changed the name of the planet. Sometimes they'll change the name of a city or a street or an airport or something, and after they know somebody who is an important figure. Here's the whole planet was named after him. And after a proper amount of time, when his sons were mature, he handed the kingdom over to his sons.
Maharaj Bharat offered the results in the name of religion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva. In other words, he performed all the yajñas for the satisfaction of Lord Vasudeva Krishna. Bharat Maharaj thought that since the demigods were different parts of Vasudeva's body, he controls those who are explained in the Vedic mantras. By thinking in this way, Maharaj Bharat was freed from material contamination such as attachment, lust, and greed. When the priests were about to offer the sacrificial ingredients into the fire, Maharaj Bharat expertly understood how the offering made to different demigods was simply an offering to the different limbs of the Supreme Lord. For instance, Indra is the arm of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Surya is his eye. Thus, Bharat Maharaj considered that the oblations offered to different demigods were actually offered unto the limbs of Vasudeva. Prabhupada makes reference to Sri Brahma Samhita, where in Sri Brahma Samhita it's Govinda Stotra, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Vajami, but various personalities are also mentioned there. And they're seen in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then therefore they're honored. Durga is honored because she's doing some nice service for the Personality of Godhead, Govinda. So she's honored in that way. So this is a little different, or quite different,
from what we're accustomed to hearing. But here's from Srila Prabhupada's purport. We should worship the demigods in this spirit. Because the goddess Durga satisfies Krishna, we should therefore offer respects, not worship, but respect to Goddess Durga. Because Lord Shiva is nothing but Krishna's functional body, we should therefore offer respects to Lord Shiva. Similarly, we should offer respects to Brahma, Agni, and Surya. There are many offerings to different demigods, and one should always remember that these offerings are usually meant to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bharat Maharaj did not aspire to receive some benediction from demigods. His aim was to please the Supreme Lord. in the Mahabharata. Among the thousand names of Vishnu, it is said, Yajna-bhuk, Yajna-krit, Yajna-ha. These are names of Vishnu, where he's the enjoyer of yajna, the performer of yajna, and yajna itself. Oh, that was Bharat Maharaj's consciousness. So as a result, what came to him, or what was the fruit of Karmakanda Yajnas, was not something impermanent, but it was something permanent. The something permanent was, it was helping to firmly establish his eternal relation with the personality of Godhead. Whereas what's forbidden for others to do this type of worship is their interest is something impermanent, the result is something impermanent, and it leads to further bondage in the world of birth and death. And therefore it's not recommended. And for all of us, we don't have to have an option, really. Number one, we're not on that platform. And number two, there aren't priests who can take us from our platform to another platform. And so we don't have that option. It's only Hare Nama, Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasdeva, Nasdeva. We all know the verse. So all of this is to help us not get bewildered by, hey, how come over there and how come over here? What's going on? Isn't there a contradiction? Prabhupada writes, when a pure devotee, such as Bharat Maharaj, executes some service through the agency of another person, he should not be criticized. For his activities are meant for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord. A devotee, such as Bharat Maharaj, may have a priest perform some karma kanda, and the priest may not be a pure Vaishnava. But because the devotee wants to please the Supreme Lord, he should not be criticized. This is like helping us to not make some mental offense against Bharat Maharaj. Or become bewildered. Prabhupada quotes the verse from the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, 4:23. The work of a man who is unattached to the modes of material nature and who is fully situated in transcendental knowledge merges entirely into transcendence. So someone on the platform of Bharat Maharaj can engage in these activities, and it's part of the path for him. It's part of the path to transcendence. So, translation for text 7. In this way, being purified by ritualistic sacrifices, the heart of Bharat Maharaj was completely uncontaminated. His devotional service unto Vasudeva, Lord Krishna, increased day after day. So that takes care of one section of his rule, then he turned his kingdom over to he divided his kingdom into five. It doesn't say he selected one amongst them as Rishabhdev did. Rishabhdev selected Bharat to be the king of the whole world. And there were others who were under him as subordinate kings. Doesn't describe like that for Bharat Maharaj. He divided his kingdom amongst his five sons.
and he left for the forest. Specifically, he left for Pulaha Ashram. Pulaha. And later Pulastya Muni. These two munis established an ashram on the bank of the Gandaki River. And there are some specific things described about Pulaha Ashram that are pretty amazing. One of them is that those who go to Pulaha Ashram and engage in their devotional practices, the Supreme Lord, being very pleased by them, he personally appears before their eyes for their darshan. And again, a nice, long, rich purport of how the Supreme Lord is very kind upon his devotee. And according to their devotion, there are various forms of the Lord, and according to their particular devotion, the Lord appears and brings them satisfaction by appearing before them. And another very special feature of the Pulaha Ashram is the Gandaki River passes through Pulaha Ashram. And what's special about that is the Gandaki River is the place where Shalagram Shilas are found just naturally. So, practically speaking, it's like a continuous Abhishek. A non-stop Abhishek, as the waters of the river are passing over the Shalagrams. All the water is Charnamrita. And so one who takes bath or drinks water from or lives by the side of this Gandaki River in Pulaha Ashram, it's very special, just as the River Jamuna is of the same, passing over the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, descending into this realm. The Gandaki River is a very, very special place. So he made his ashram there. And quite different from when he was king, he had all royal opulence. Living in the forest, he just had whatever was produced by nature. So whatever forest vegetables and forest fruits and forest roots were there, that was what he made his offerings to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And with these offered foods, with these, he offered food to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, and worshipped him, and remained satisfied. In this way, his heart was completely uncontaminated, and he did not have the least desire for material enjoyment. All material desires vanished. Imagine that state. All material desires vanished. In this steady position, he felt full satisfaction and was situated in devotional service. So, how do you get there? Prabhupada writes, everybody is searching for peace of mind. But you won't, as long as there are material desires, there's not peace of mind. Material desires will always demand attention and not allow you to be peaceful. But when only when there's no desire for sense gratification, so it's replaced with the desire for satisfying the desire of the Supreme Lord. And when there's that desire is progressively established, then there's no greater happiness.
and there's not the constant struggle for the unpleasant disturbances that come within the mind. It's simply absent. So, what about us? How do we apply this principle? We apply this principle just as it's advised in Bhagavad Gita. From the preliminary stages of devotional service, we're instructed to tolerate the pushings and the pullings of the senses and the sense objects. Matra, sparshas, tupanteya. These attractions and repulsions of the senses for sense objects, it's just within the mind. And we're instructed by Krishna to tolerate that. And if there may be some practical things that you do to address some disturbance. If it's very cold, you may put on some warm clothes or a heater. Or it's very hot, you may turn on the fan. But if your whole life is meant and absorbed in climate control, how are you going to absorb yourself? At a certain point, you make some basic arrangements and you move on. And you tolerate. Live in Vrindavan for a while, you learn to tolerate. Sometimes there's electricity, sometimes there's no electricity. Sometimes it's very cold, sometimes it's blasting hot. I mean, the world is like that, but some places it's more severe than other places. And I've often thought about this. When we read or hear the glorification of the six Goswamis that came and stayed in Vrindavan and they slept under a tree, specifically, it means they didn't have any stone dwellings. So we have a problem. I have a problem. We have a problem when, there's no central heating. It's a stone building and no central heating. Well, what about, it's summertime, there's no stone dwelling to stay under. Or in the winter, no stone dwelling to close the doors and or keep the mosquitoes out or whatever. The level of tolerance of the Goswamis, who can understand? And formerly they were government officers. They had everything that position and wealth can purchase. And they left it all. Prabhupada is giving us in his purport here an explanation of how we can apply. He says we may not be able to go to Pulaha Ashram and engage in meditation and devotional service like Bharat Maharaj, but the same principles we can apply. Savai Pungsan Karo Dharmo Yato Bhaktira Hoksa Jay Ahaita Kiya Pratiyata Yayatma Supersivati Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojasaha Janayati Ashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayadahaitikam. You know those verses from first canto. Those principles are to be applied in our lives. And the standard form of how that can look, Prabhupada gave us in the form of his activities within the ISKCON society. So we apply those principles in our lives, and the outcome, if we sincerely and diligently and carefully apply them, the same outcome is accessible to us. Here, this is in the retired from his occupational duty stage of life, after 10,000 times 1,000 years. So, by following his prescribed duties in the course of his life, he was then qualified that his mind could become completely absorbed like this at the final stage of his life. But progressively, it's material desires that cause us a feeling of dissatisfaction. It's not the process of devotional service, there's something missing in it. There's some esoteric teaching that if we just kind of elevate ourselves enough, we'll come to understand some hidden teaching that's not given to us. The teaching is openly presented to everybody. So how carefully we apply it will help us to feel satisfaction or not. And that satisfaction comes when the material desires become cleansed. And the material desires have become cleansed to the degree that the desire or the happiness of Krishna is the purpose behind each of the things that we do. That's bhakti. The happiness of Krishna is my goal. Satisfying Krishna is my goal. Same as we heard in South India, where Bhakti Chaitanya instructed both Kurma and Vasudeva what they should do. Stay in their position and hear topics about Krishna. Perform devotional service from your present position and cultivate the satisfaction of Krishna element. We'll see how important this is as this Bharat Maharaj story unfolds, because he becomes very accomplished in the course of doing what's been described, what he does, what he did in his Pulaha Ashram days. Literally, he was experiencing ecstasy. Symptoms of ecstasy were erupting in his body as he was sitting there doing his meditation and his chanting of Gayatri Mantra and his making of offerings. He was so fixed upon the personality Godhead from the core of his heart, the soul was in ecstasy of love. And he achieved the Bhava Bhakti stage, which is beyond the sadhana bhakti stage, and it's just on the threshold of prema bhakti. Just from this fixing his mind upon the personality of Godhead and rendering of these various duties. Naturally, his love for Vasudeva Krishna increased more and more and melted his heart. Consequently, he gradually lost all attachment for regulative duties. The hairs of his body stood on end, and all the ecstatic bodily symptoms were manifest. Tears flowed from his eyes, so much so that he could not see anything. Thus, he constantly meditated on the reddish lotus feet of the Lord. At that time, his heart, which was like a lake, was filled with the water of ecstatic love. When his mind was immersed in that lake, he even forgot the regulative service of the Lord. We know this from Nectar Devotion. This is the Bhava Bhakti stage. One may not attend to all the vidhis of Vaidhisadhana Bhakti, and there's no harm in that, because the purpose of those vidhis is to bring one to the stage, having attained the stage. It's not like he was thinking, oh, I've outgrown that now. He was just so absorbed like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he would not always do all of his duties. And sometimes he would do his duties just without you know, the just out of habit. Or, you know, the purpose, when we're doing our duties properly, it's we're taking them as assisting us to absorb our thought in Krishna. And when one's thought is so absorbed in Krishna, it's the stage of ecstatic love, bhava bhakti, like Bharat Maharaj, those duties would gradually fall away. Their importance to him was diminished by the stage of absorbed consciousness that he achieved. Ecstatic love of God. In his ecstasy, in addition to chanting of the Gayatri Mantra, he composed a particular spontaneous personal verse that he would recite. So I'm just going to read the translation of that. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, thinking that his ecstatic symptoms were an obstacle to his meditation, what he was interested in was meditation or absorption of his mind upon the personality God had. Ecstatic symptoms were interfering with it, so he wanted to get rid of those ecstatic symptoms. So with his intelligence, he contemplated another prayer that could help him just stay fixed in thought of the personality of Godhead. So here's that prayer. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated in pure goodness. He illuminates the entire universe and bestows all benedictions upon his devotees. The Lord has created this universe from his own spiritual potency. According to his desire, the Lord entered this universe as the Supersoul, and by virtue of his different potencies, he is maintaining all living entities desiring material enjoyment. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Lord, who is the giver of intelligence. So, it's revealing. One of the things that this prayer is revealing, Prabhupada explains, is the mistaken notion that Gayatri Mantra is meditating on something impersonal or the sun is refuted. It's directly, it's the personality of Godhead, who not only is maintaining the universe, but is the very source of the universe through his spiritual potencies. Here's a very nice explanation of that verse by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. I surrender Imaha to the effulgence Bhargava of the Lord situated in the sun. So the Lord is situated in the sun, and he has an effulgence. That refers to Narayana, indicated in, there's another Rig Veda mantra that specifically mentions Narayana. And this Lord Narayan, he's in Shuddha Sattva. He's beyond material nature, so he's situated within, he creates the world and he enters within it. He enters within it as the Lord of the presiding deity of the sun, but also another expansion within the heart of every living being. So as the yogis are meditating on the super soul within the heart, this Gayatri mantra is meditating upon that same Supreme Lord, but who is situated in as the predominating deity of the sun. And from his position within the heart, he's maintaining all living entities by intelligence. So how is that? Entering the world by the power of his chit shakti as the super soul, he sees the jiva like me, desiring happiness from material objects. So now it can go either one of two ways. The Lord sees us desiring material objects. He gives us the intelligence how we can obtain and manipulate things to try to use those material objects for sense gratification. Or He can give us the intelligence to not pursue those material objects and instead remain fixed in contemplation upon Him. Either way, he's maintaining the materialist or he's maintaining the transcendentalist. And the Lord sees, it's very important because this is the mistake that Bharat Maharaj makes later. He consciously chooses the wrong option. Although he's composed this wonderful verse, he's praying according to this wonderful verse. The Lord doesn't interfere with the option of his devotee to misuse free will. And Bharat Maharaj's fall is because he misused his free will. He consciously misused his free will. Although he very clearly knows better, indicated by his, 10,000 times 1,000 years of practice. He understood and still he chose otherwise. So if the prayer says that the Lord who is the worshipable Lord who I'm offering this worship through a chanting of Gayatri Mantra, he's maintaining the whole universe and he's maintaining all the living entities within this whole universe, which he has created by his own potency, and he's maintaining them, even those that have material desires, by intelligence, how to manipulate things to try to enjoy matter. We're going to need some oil for that squeaky door. This means he maintains the jiva out of his mercy. How? He maintains the jiva by inspiring the jiva's intelligence. Nrishat means the intelligence. What remains to man as a covering. The Lord gives movement, Rigiram, to the intelligence of man. May my intelligence, concentrating on the Lord, not be covered by anything. That's the prayer that he spontaneously, after long periods of uninterrupted devotional ecstasy, was praying. My dear Lord, just like our 15:15 Bhagavad Gita verse, Sarva Shachaham Vidhi Sannivishto Matak Smritir Jnanam Apohanam Cha. Please give me always remembrance of you. Please protect me from the tendency to be forgetful, because you can supply forgetfulness too. You're the source of remembrance and knowledge and forgetfulness. Please give me always remembrance of you. Please protect me from that other option, because the tendency is there. The tendency is there in every conditioned soul. The path of bhakti, now we'll go back to our position. We're sadhana bhaktas. We're not on the bhava bhakti stage. On the sadhana bhakti stage, we need to be very careful. We need to not only follow things nicely, But gee whiz, Bharat Maharaj was following things nicely for a longer time than we can even think about. So it's not just following things nicely. We need to follow things nicely, but that's not all. The purpose behind that is something that's important. The consciousness behind the activity, just like the consciousness behind his engaging priests in Karmakanda rituals. His purpose was very clear. And therefore, it was elevating him, not binding him. Similarly, the direct devotional practices that we do, the purpose behind them should be mindful. And the prayer should be by this japa, or by this kirtan, or by this hearing of Bharat Maharaj's story from Srimad Bhagavatam in Vrindavan Dham. Let that uplift my heart and bring me closer to you with exclusive devotion. Let that, by your mercy, please give me that intelligence. Vidami buddhiyogam tam yena mam upayanti te. But what's the first part? Desham satasa yuktanam bhajatam 54 vatam. So we fulfill that part and Krishna does this part. But we have to be clear what our purpose is. Whatever level, whatever stage of devotional service, we may be in a struggling stage. Maybe, you know, way down in the struggling stage. But let our purpose be clear. And you call out to Krishna sincerely with such a purpose, Krishna extends. Krishna reciprocates with that sincere call to his, from his devotee. That's how the process of bhakti works at whatever level of Krishna consciousness we may presently be on. So that's the seventh chapter of Canto 5. That's the history, the lineage of Bharat Maharaj, how he became king, handed over from Rishabdev. He found how he executed his duties as the king, the devotional practice that he followed as the king, and then the final was what he did when he was in the forest at Pulaha Ashram, and how he became completely unattracted to any material desire, undisturbed by the flow of material desire into the mind, and was fixed in Bhava Bhakti, on the threshold of Prema Bhakti. Then comes the deer. That's the beginning of the next one. Next chapter. Any comments or questions? Yes?
That is there, the feeling is there that Varnashram is important, but then you emphasize on...
It's important for the world that we live in to become elevated by the principles of the Varnashram if they are unprepared to take up the direct processes of hearing and chanting. Now, we can just give them the option of hearing and chanting. Or we can give them the option of hearing and chanting is the goal,
take up these varnashram duties, and they'll, and part of what taking up varnashram duties is they have to have examples, so you have to show by example, here's how you do it. But the purpose of here's how you do it is to show by example. Like Prabhupada, there's a nice photograph of Srila Prabhupada showing Dwarkadish how to write Sanskrit characters. So the Prabhupada's hand is on top of his little hand, and he's making, you know, the movement. This is how you make the Sanskrit character. Like that, showing by example. Not that Prabhupada didn't know how to write the alphabet. He knew how to write the alphabet. He's showing the Dwarkadish how to write the alphabet. We may also show by example, here's how you perform varnashram duties. But that's not the platform that we're being encouraged to function on. It's something to help those who can't directly hear and chant to do something that can elevate them out of the animal kingdom into the human kingdom. Form of life.
Yeah. Sometimes by doing that also, like say, there are people who imitate, say some pure devotee of the Lord sees the time, place, circumstance and puts some things like Prabhupada wanted varnashram and all. Yeah. But then it can sometimes dilute and create a lot of confusion in the people, in sense, because of lack of so many voices, because of the way we have it, the democratic world we call it.
Sure.
Exactly,
that's why I brought up the point that I brought up. Because it can be very confusing. It's not that Prabhupada didn't want it, but what did Prabhupada want? Let's be clear what Prabhupada wanted. There's many things about varnashram that's confusing. But that's, you know, that's a good starting point to get clear. Like, how do you do it? This is where it's known. From where we are to there, how do you get from here to there? Now, it's one thing to say, you know, it's a whole lot. One thing to say, you can understand, generally tomorrow speaks like this. You go to a rural village somewhere in India and you see what varnashram is. It's very clear what it is. You see it, this has been happening for generations and generations and centuries and centuries and centuries. It's there. But how do you go from where we are to there? That's where a lot of confusion comes in varnashram talks. But one point I wanted to establish is, it's not for us that we're not doing something we're supposed to be doing. Unless we're not chanting our rounds and chanting our Gayatri mantras. Engaging in the Shravana Kirtana Vishnu process of Bhagavad. If we're doing those things, we're not neglecting our duties. But it's rather for a broader expansion of contact of Vedic culture to the world in Sanatana Dharma or Vaidyamana Ashram for persons who can't take up hearing and chanting correctly. Just they're not inclined. They like rituals. So we can give them some way that they can be familiar.
So if a person engages knowing the tendencies of the people, that they are not so inclined to, not capable of pure devotion, accepting it immediately. So if they engage them in particular activities which might elevate them gradually.
Yes.
Does the because the like Bharat Maharaj was a very advanced devotee.
Yes.
So does the credit of his devotion go to these people who are like engaging under his guidance?
Yeah.
And
And he didn't make the mistake that you were describing earlier. He didn't get watered down. He didn't get diluted. he became elevated because he was fixed on the purpose. Not only engaging the citizens, but meditating upon the personality of God, the essence. He became elevated. Oh, anyway, I'm amplifying the point you made earlier. We want, some members of ISKCON start going in the direction of implementing that of Varnashram, they should not become Varnashramites. They should become, you know, high Christian devotees that are teaching the people how to perform Varnashram by setting an example for them. And not neglecting, or in any way, diminishing their sadhana bhakti practices. Yeah.
This kind of feeling of engaging with people somehow or the other is the root is deep compassion. But there are different levels of Vaishnavas, and then when they are preaching, it is not always that they are in that same different stages. So, but then they use the same principle, unless they are strongly connected to their own perceptors. I'm not able to understand is that. Yes.
They now come is given the scenario you just described, if they're not so well connected, they'll fall. And that's not nice. We don't want to see people fall. We want to see people become elevated. The purpose being to extend so other people can elevate that I fall. That's precisely what happened to Bhagavatars. On the basis of misplaced compassion. That's exactly what happened.
Yes. So Maharaj, to summarize, so are you saying that we Brahmana Vaishnavas or Kshatriya Vaishnavas, like Vaishnavas first, and then we may do these things to set an example? Is that?
Yeah, I would not use the nomenclature that you used initially. But saying we're Vaishnavas. We're not, American Vaishnavas and Indian Vaishnavas, or Brahmin Vaishnavas and Kshatriya Vaishnavas. We're Vaishnavas. And if we just use our faith, if we open our heart and mind, we're Vaishnavas. And we're teaching something of Vedic, just like you can teach somebody, violin or harmonium. We're Vaishnavas, we're not harmonium teachers. We may teach vegetarian cooking, but we're not vegetarian cooking teachers. We're Vaishnavas. So similarly, we teach both theory and practice something. That's not our identity. Our identity is from the eternal service of Krishna, and we shouldn't lose that identity and think otherwise. And become caught up in that thinking otherwise. I just personally have a concern that when we go down the path, which is something that some of our very clear thinking, strong spiritually devotees do, because Prabhupada said it, that we're very cautious as example setting leaders, and like you're the same, some persons aren't going to be so strong. They're going to lose their Krishna consciousness by imitating those persons that are showing by example how this is how you do it. They'll become identified with that which Krishna consciousness isn't. In the name of Prabhupada wanted us to do it. It's because they're not spiritually mature, or they're not sufficiently training the Krishna consciousness to do it properly. So it needs to be perceived with caution. Something else? Yes?
You were describing that consciousness may be downward, maybe we may be in a studying position, but we should be very clear of the goal. But for me, it sounds like a little contradictory, as because if we are in some lower modes or we are stuck in some areas of life, so we lose that
There's a noise toward the end. What do you not say the last part, not the whole thing. The last part. Some struggling period of life. Okay. You can't hold on to the goal of life, then whatever it is that you do, whether it's this level, the topmost level, the medium level, or the lower level, if you're not able to capture the goal, then according to the language of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's useless. Shrama Evahi Kevalam. Whatever it is. Now, useless in terms of attaining the goal, because you can attain benefit from any one of those things. Top, most, intermediate, bottom. Some benefit. But not the ultimate benefit, not the spiritual, real essence benefit. Therefore, it's very important to have a clear sense of how often would Prabhupada speak like this? Natte vidu svartha katimbi vishnu. People don't know what the goal of life is. Ask a professor. Ask a big scientist. Ask a big politician. What's the goal of life? The answer is going to be in terms of sense gratification or mental speculation, one or the other. But the goal of the soul and the well-being of the soul, they don't know. Not te vidu sva artha gatim hi vishnu. They don't know. And so, for someone who has lost track of the goal of life, they need to be informed the goal of life. So if we're just, particularly in terms of this varnashram topic, if we're going to help people understand varnashram, we should be wise enough to understand, are they capable of coming to the direct practices of sadhana bhakti? If so, let's just give them that. Directly. Along with, here's what the goal is. Sadhana bhakti, the goal is to achieve your eternal relation with Krishna. And someone may not be able to perform that sadhana bhakti. That's like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the 12th chapter. Always think of me and engage your intelligence always in me. In this way, you'll live in me always without a doubt. If you can't do that, follow the regulations of bhakti and you'll develop the desire to achieve that. If you can't do that, work for me. If you can't do that, try to be self-situated. So there's levels, but the goal doesn't change. So just I'm trying my best to reframe your question. If someone is a neophyte in devotional practice and they've lost sight of the goal and they're struggling, they hit a patch where they're disoriented and they're struggling, we don't need to change the process. We need to help them refocus on the goal, accept their present position, I'm struggling, and keep in mind the goal and continue to feel some support to follow the process. That's what we should do. Now there's a big world out there of so many people that are just totally unregulated. You know, frighteningly unregulated. And they need something, some kind of frame of reference to operate from that's going to help them, like, you know, wet wood to become dry wood before you put the wood in the fire. Something like that. So amongst those who are strong sadhana bhakti followers, that hear this message from our founder Acharya, let's cast a bigger net. Let's find some way that some persons that aren't relating to the Vedic process at all accept the Vedic process. That's major undertaking, a lot of work, and so forth. As we heard, there's risk involved in doing this as well. But for us, now back to what I said earlier, the orientation should be, once again, let's put everything on hold and ask yourself the question, why did you start practicing Krishna consciousness to begin with? Now, yeah, hit the refresh button. What am I doing? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I even interested in doing what I'm interested in doing? Why am I struggling like this with something that if I don't even have a clear idea, what's the goal? So it's good to, you know, from time to time, either by circumstance or just do it on purpose. Refresh. I use the phrase, you know, rejoin the Hare Krishna movement. Why am I doing this? If you're asking yourself that question progressively, then it doesn't have to be this big catharsis that happens from time to time. Big emotional upheaval about, you know, do I really want to do this? Ask yourself the question, why am I doing this? It's healthy. It's happy. I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. We shouldn't just be doing something mindlessly and then later on in a state where we lose track of where we're headed, we're completely lost. Better to be mindful or be present each step that we take. So, in the scenario that I thought I heard from you, or at least I heard from you, maybe imperfectly, devotees do undergo periods where they're challenged how to go further. And as you said, the goal is lost. So now what? Seek the association of those who are close advisors of you and express your heart. I've lost the goal and I'm out in the forest here. I don't know even what a path looks like anymore, but to speak of which one is the right one. Help. And then go back to basics. It's good. Maybe it's like uncomfortable or embarrassing or something, but it's good. Am I addressing your question? Speak loud. We don't need a microphone. We just need him to speak loud. You just like Prabhupada did. Did you hear the question? Kind of. The capacity to take up devotional service comes from the pure devotee who's giving it. Whether one is, you know, whatever one's previous activity is, it's descending mercy. And so, if that's the case, how is the person who's giving to a beginner, how do they decide which choice to make? should I just give him the chanting of the holy name, or should I give him this Varnashram thing? And my answer is that Prabhupada gave the holy name. When he saw the persons just were not able to follow that process of chanting the holy name, then he said, here's they're a candidate for this other. You give them the best thing. And give all the support to do the best thing. And if they're just not able to do it, then you go to the other one. Because they don't want to. They don't want to. Try to make a child eat that doesn't want to eat. And then you ask them, how come you're not eating? I don't want to. And you give them all the reasons why it's necessary. And their position is, I don't want to. What can you do? Well, at least do this. Okay, I'll do this. It's like that. It's not, you know. But to say, you know, it's not that they can't, it's they are choosing otherwise. The persons that can't chant. What's the can't to chant? It's easy. And the mind is filled with too many material desires. All right? And they're unwilling to take that cure that will help relieve them of their material desire. Yeah. They didn't hear. They're not even so much not accepting. They just didn't hear. Ask them what it is that you're not accepting, and they can't tell you. They'll say something other than what you've been telling them. They don't want it. They don't want it. That's coming up tomorrow morning. Ask this question tomorrow morning. Yes. In preliminary stages, one should tolerate. What comes next after that? We may not. Just like the sound outside. You can go for the plug. Or we tolerate. We, you know, close the windows, close the doors. We, you know, we take certain precautions, but at a certain point you just tolerate. That's different. Not necessarily. One has to be aware of what it is that's irritating. I mean, it's not what's the root. The root is, it's not just there's a stone in my shoe or a thorn in my foot. It's, you know, I've got a material body. Close the door. Let's go a little deeper besides, you know, the stone in my shoe. Why do I have a mature body? That it's causing me a problem. Because after I take the stone out of my shoe, then it's going to be something else, and then something else, and then something else. And endlessly making life as a series of adjustments, of disturbances. What's the big picture? And if we can turn our, to the degree we can turn our attention to the root cause, we will find that fewer stones will show up on our shoes. Some will come, because it's the nature of the place. And there may be carriers in our devotional service that a whole bunch of things happen all at once. Like, out of nowhere, I'm going along and everything's... Then all of a sudden something, then a whole bunch of something, then a whole bunch of somethings. You know what I mean? And then, you know, just... depend on Krishna, and then sometimes they just resolve themselves one after the next after the next. So, back to the same formula. To some extent, we pay attention to those things, to make some practical arrangements. We don't obsess over making practical arrangements and become obsessed and overwhelmed, and, you know, our life becomes filled with that. Circumstances of life. We're going to be covering this again further tomorrow morning, but circumstances of life present themselves sometimes as an opportunity to learn something about ourselves, to learn something or become more dependent upon Krishna, or something like that. It's not even just, you know, a problem that needs a solution. Anything else?
Yes, practicing devotees. How can we associate our persons in listening to devotee worship, or how do we deal with them or live with them?
Like that. What Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is, do not disturb the faith. So that's how we deal with it. But if you find that they leave the door open a little bit, you can enter. It's not difficult to take a stick and beat them. And the stick is Bhagavad Gita. And just let them have it. But that's not how to bring people to Krishna consciousness. That's how to beat people. But not to bring them to Krishna consciousness. If you rather, if you show how happy you are, and what good qualities you have, and what a fine person you are, that's going to be more attractive than any stick. See? I'm chanting my thinking something else than what we're thinking, but. So here we are, we're in a situation where they're worshipping demigods and we're in their little ashram. So how do we interact with these people? They see what we're doing, they see what our qualities are, they see how happy we are. That's more compelling than anything else. And there, you know, the person that gets paid to do what he's doing out there, he's going to keep doing it. But the people that are coming and going, the innocent people, you know, maybe they'll pay some attention, and we have some books and some prasadam and like that. And we find somebody that's interested, just have them come and attend the class. And gently. You were also in Hyderabad when I was in Hyderabad. When I was leaving Hyderabad, I took an airplane. And as I was getting ready to board the plane, one of the employees came up and just like over his shoulder, walking along with me because like he wanted to be inconspicuous. He said, "I saw you at the temple on Sunday." "I heard your lecture. And that story you told about the airport," and he said, "that was a good one." And I said, "Oh, do you regularly come to the temple?" He said, "No, I just started coming to the temple. One of my friends advised me, so it's just like in the past month or so I've been coming, and it's very nice." So I didn't say, you know, "I hope you're not going to some demigod worship." Same principle, you follow? You know, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, but okay. Something else? Yeah.
Offering prayers because he was having these ecstatic symptoms. He was, in order to stop it, he was offering prayers.
I just read to you that he wanted his mind to be absorbed in Vasudeva. Ecstatic symptoms were disturbing, so something that helped him fix his mind upon Vasudeva was a personal prayer. Yes.
Why are these symptoms called ecstatic? Why?
It's a technical term. It's not like he tried to have them happen and then they started happening. It's just transformations of, you know, from the life errors and so forth. Symptoms would come.
Actually, that this world is content and nature. Like that is not described. And it's just that Adi has not come in this. He has not come in this. But those are external. Why do you call it sector?
What I get from what you're saying is the second canto describes these symptoms as something that are desirable. Now here's somebody who is having them and they're undesirable. That's what you're saying?
No, Maharaj, you mean like rather describing the actual qualities that cause this, say, because...
But it's also describing the, you know, his condition of heart in both cases, in the second canto as well as here. His condition of heart is compared to a lake. And, you know, should I read it again? This beautiful metaphor. If that's not the bodily symptoms, it's his heart. And because his heart is in this tumultuous state, it's erupting in his body. Should I read it again? Okay. Naturally his love for Vasudev, Krishna, increased more and more and melted his heart. He gradually lost all attachment for regulative duties. This is text 12. The hairs of his body stood on end, and all the ecstatic bodily symptoms were manifest. Tears flowed from his eyes, so much so that he could not see anything. Thus he constantly meditated on the reddish lotus feet of the Lord. At that time, his heart, which was like a lake, was filled with the water of ecstatic love. When his mind was immersed in that lake, he even forgot the regulative service to the Lord. So there are symptoms that are external, and there are symptoms that are internal. There's his heart. He's not just like contemplating. He's in rapturous love. And there's symptoms. Here's Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary. He had no enthusiasm to perform daily duties because his heart was melted with affection for the Lord. The hairs on his body stood on end. His intelligence was submerged in the lake. In his heart, which was deep with the nectar of great joy, spread everywhere. External was caused by what's internal. And to minimize the influence of the external possibly taking away his absorption upon the Lord, he spontaneously came up with a wonderful prayer. Now, one could imagine that increased his ecstasy. But it was, you know, to keep his sobriety, fixing his attention on the personality of Godhead. Okay. I think we'll end there and let these people do their program. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.